Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Ramiro Funes. I'm the National Co-Secretary of Fight Imperialism Stand Together, FIST. We are a revolutionary socialist youth group that is dedicated to fighting U.S. imperialism at home and abroad. And we decided to co-sponsor this very important forum for this conference because we felt that imperialism is a very important topic that can create many divisions among the left in terms of how to approach what is imperialism, how to approach imperialism, and how do we go about discussing the origins of it. So this is a very important panel for us to be participating in. Before moving forward with our program, I just thought I would mention, give a few remarks on what my conception is of the empire that we're talking about that is in crisis. The word empire has been used in many different ways, whether in academia or just in activism. And I think it's important to really kind of talk about what empire we're discussing, what are the problems that we're specifically addressing, and how to go about creating a unified movement against this empire that we're trying to shed light on. So I wanted to kind of give a title for my general remarks, which would be the bourgeois empire and capitalist crisis. I decided to use the adjective bourgeois before empire, just to kind of give a more specific sense to what kind of empire we're talking about. And throughout history, there have been many kinds of empires, and I think it's important for us to really zero in on what kind of empire we're talking about and who is the class in charge of this empire. So as I like to do in a few other talks, I kind of just want to go over some very brief definitions, especially for those viewing this online. I think it would be very helpful to kind of give a brief sketch of what the terminology that we're using. The term bourgeois is used synonymously with bourgeoisie as a way to describe a ruling class that accompanied the capitalist revolution, the industrial revolution. You have one of the most famous examples after the French Revolution, during the French Revolution, the struggle between the aristocracy and the bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie representing the future capitalist society, the future capitalist class that would own the means of production in different cities around, not just Europe, but around the world. So the bourgeois, the word bourgeois is used to describe the bourgeoisie, the ruling class of every society. And perhaps the most notable use of the word is in the Communist Manifesto, 1848, I believe, Karl Marx, and the first line, you know, is a very important one that relates to this workshop, you know, which is the history of hitherto existing society is a history of class struggle, and the bourgeoisie represents part of a class society in general, because class society transcends capitalism. Class society is also seen in slave society and in feudal society, etc. So this is talking about a specific class within the larger context of class society as a whole. Now, what is an empire? An empire is generally defined as an extensive group of states or countries that are under a single or supreme authority. That supreme authority can manifest itself in many ways. It can be a monarch, an oligarchy, it can be capital, it can be money. So an empire, the empire that we're talking about today is basically that supreme authority, which is capital, and the capitalists, the bourgeoisie, that expresses its power and dominion over an extensive group of states and countries, religions, and different formations of society in general. Capitalism is the economic and political system based on private ownership and profit, where all social interactions are mediated by capital. where one class is in possession of capital and the other class, the proletariat class, is only able to sell their labor. That's their only form of capital, that, which is eventually exploited. That's capitalism in a rough sketch of capitalism. And finally, crisis. Crisis can be understood in many ways. I think that there's one banner that really stands out in my mind from Occupy Wall Street that really helped me to understand what capitalism was all about. And it was very simple, and it said, capitalism equals crisis. And I think that's very important, because crisis, a lot of times, by a lot of bourgeois economists, in regards to empire and imperialism, is oftentimes seen as a separate event, as not the normal state of capitalism. Crisis is seen as of something new that's caused by something else that's outside of capitalism and not inherent in it. But if we use Marx's analysis of, you know, empire and capitalism and imperialism, we understand that crisis is built into capitalism, and that the whole nature of capitalism is constant reoccurring crises that take on different forms in different places around the world. And this is where the empire comes into play. And this is where our discussion of which empire are we talking about, this is where it comes into play, because there is a metamorphosis of imperialism. The word metamorphosis has been used by Marx to describe the dialectical changes in the appearance of capitalism, in the appearance of capital and imperialism as a whole. So the empire that we're talking about is not a static empire that lives in a vacuum. It's one that's constantly changing and evolving and finding new ways to extract profit, because after all, this is based on the capitalist system, based on private ownership. This empire is constantly in a process of metamorphosis, where its appearance changes depending on which part of the world we're talking about. So in talking about domestic issues in terms of, you know, let's say Detroit and, you know, how the free trade agreements have affected Detroit, you can see the metamorphosis, you can see imperialism and capitalism have take a specific appearance in Detroit, and it may take another appearance in, let's say, Palestine, where, you know, U.S. finance capital is making money off of the construction of facilities that are used to imprison Palestinians. So they may seem like completely different appearances of capitalism and the empire in crisis, but ultimately they're part of that same metamorphosis of imperialism that keeps on changing and keeps on evolving. And that's part of the reason why there are so many disagreements about capitalism, because of our understanding of the way it changes. It's like a river. It keeps on flowing, and you know, there's that saying by Heraclitus, you know, you never step in the same river twice, and that's kind of the way it works with imperialism and the empire. Is you're never affected by imperialism. You may not be affected by imperialism in the same exact way. It'll take on different appearances, but they're ultimately part of that same body of water, of river, of currency, of capital, and I also wanted to give some examples of past manifestations of imperialism and the empire in crisis. I think it's important to kind of track where we are today in terms of imperialism and the empire, the bourgeois empire that we're talking about, and seeing what were the preconditions that brought us here. Some previous examples of the empire in crisis, I would say, you can look at the 20th century policies in Latin America with the United States, 1954, Jacobo Arbenz. At that point, you know, there was a economic crisis in the United States where there weren't enough countries, there weren't as many countries anymore to invade and to make profits from fruit. So you have companies like United Fruit Company, Dole, et cetera, that are pushing, lobbying these interest groups in the U.S. government to implement expansionary policies in Latin America. And they have very brute and raw examples in the 20th century 1954 in Guatemala. You have the 1930s in Nicaragua. You have 1973 with Salvador Allende, and you have so many examples of this kind of the infant stage of the empire in crisis that uses direct, overt force, which is very obvious: tanks, machine guns, and basically right-wing fascist governments that they supported in order to maximize profits for the empire that's already collapsing. That has changed up until today, and there has been a metamorphosis of the effects of the empire in crisis in the way that imperialism works today. We see in all over the world, and not only in Latin America, Africa, and Asia, but even in oppressed cities in the United States, you have the rise of the NGO apparatus, the rise of think tanks, the rise of all these private companies that are seemingly independent and isolated of the government because they just slap on the word independent in their name and aren't disclosing their fund, and they say they're not receiving money from the government, but they're still part of that empire in crisis. They're an extension. They're an auxiliary of the empire in crisis. And that is the way that imperialism manifests itself today in many of these areas, with NGOs, think tanks, and private corporations basically seeing how they can quantify and privatize and carve up every little last remaining piece of territory that's available. You see it happening in Detroit with the rise of gentrification and people basically appraising lands and seeing how much they can make out of it, and et cetera, with think tanks. And we also see it happening, all over the Middle East with the U.S. imperialism in Syria and Iraq, et cetera, with all of these private advisors, coming in and appraising the land and figuring out how they can use that for the empire. So that's generally it. Overall, I just wanted to make that point that when talking about the empire in crisis, we have to discuss capitalism, we have to talk about the bourgeoisie, and we have to say that this empire is constantly in motion and is constantly changing its appearance. It takes on many appearances. I would say the current appearance and manifestation of it is, we see with neoliberal foreign policy. And I think, in the 20th century, it kind of took on a neocon, more kind of right-wing appearance, et cetera, and it takes on different forms. So I just wanted to really make that clear that the empire in crisis, imperialism, is constantly changing, constantly evolving, constantly in motion. And it's our task here today to really provide sort of snapshots of what that looks like today. Thank you. And I guess we'll get started with Comrade Teresa Gutierrez.
She said she wanted to speak last.
Oh, I apologize for that.
Okay.
Yeah, that's totally fine, of course. So I guess we'll begin with Abayomi.
Okay, thank you, Brumera. Yeah, I just wanted to talk about both the domestic as well as the international aspect of the current world crisis. Two assumptions that we often hear through the corporate media here in the United States as well as in Europe is the claims of economic growth. That's one. And also the notion that the interventions of various imperialist states are on the decline with the ostensible end of the Iraq War, the ostensible end of the Afghan War. But as we all know, those wars are continuing in different forms. And there are still U.S. troops in Afghanistan. There are still U.S. troops in Iraq. And, of course, the United States is escalating its military interventions in the Middle East as well as in Africa. Now, since 2007 and 2008, the world capitalist system has remained in grave crisis. The crisis has not ended. This is the reality of the social situation, despite the claims made daily by the United States corporate media. Most periodicals and broadcast networks here in the United States suggest that the problems of joblessness, home foreclosures, cutbacks on educational and public services, which we tend to describe as austerity, have largely been corrected under the current administration of President Barack Obama. Every month, the public is presented with an unemployment rate that does not take into consideration key factors in analyzing the strength of the economy. Now, even though it is said that the official jobless rate is around 5.6% in the United States, what is typically not said is that the labor participation rate within the United States is the lowest that it has been in 40 years, meaning that people who are eligible to work and want to work cannot find full-time employment. So if you adjust the labor participation rate with the actual unemployment rate, there's a huge disparity there. The index determines the number of people eligible or desirous of being employed in the formal sector of the labor market, but have been systematically excluded for various reasons. Now, there are many ways of judging the impact of this unemployment, these unemployment figures that we hear every month. We'll be hearing them again early next month. It is true that many others work in the informal sector of the U.S. economy, which involves small business transactions. It involves employment that is not reported to the federal government, as well as contract labor that is not necessarily recorded with the Department of Labor. Nonetheless, the pundits of the corporate media who promote the notion of an inevitable advancement of U.S. capitalism heavily rely on faith. I mean, it's not a scientific approach that they take. They have faith that the capitalist system will never collapse or that it will recorrect itself. They taught us that in college, you know, that you have this boom-bust cycle and it, you know, continuously refurbishes itself. But what we've seen in the last several decades is that the overall income and social wealth of the working class people and even people who consider themselves middle class has declined precipitously. Despite the virtual zero growth rates reported by the government, these statistics are ignored or dismissed as a temporary aberration within the broader framework of the capitalist expansion. For example, in the first quarter of this year, and I just want to quote one of the leading financial analysts who wrote recently that, quote, having come through 2015's first quarter with virtually no growth, in fact, they just adjusted it a couple of days ago, it indicated that the economy actually contracted by some 0.2 of a percent. The U.S. economy is generally expected to pick up during the rest of this year. Faith again. Indeed, as we move into a new quarter and shake off the effects of a significant West Coast dock strike and severe winter weather, forward indicators have pointed towards better growth, unquote. This is from Franklin Templeton's investment. These are leading capitalist analysts who actually advise banks and corporations on how to carry out their business. So they're even admitting that the economy is shrinking, that there's problems in the labor movement, and also that there may not be growth later on this year. This same report continues saying that, quote, the Institute for Supply Management Purchasing Managers Index for non-manufacturing rose to 57.8 in April, well above the 50 mark that separates expansion from contraction, suggesting that activity in the U.S. services sector, which accounts for the lion's share of the American economy, has continued to march higher, unquote. More faith. Now, whether these figures represent an actual march higher cannot overshadow that the so-called service sector is where wages for workers are the lowest. That's why we have all these demonstrations taking place all over the country, people demanding $15 an hour in a union. It is also the sector where job security and potential for promotion and pay increases is the most remote. You know, people get stuck in these positions. There's really no raises. There's no opportunities for advancement, and they could easily be laid off. Look at what happened to Radio Shack, for example. You know, they went bankrupt and they've closed thousands of locations across the United States, putting, you know, untold numbers of people out of work. But you don't hear about it typically in the major newspapers. Now, contradictorily, this projection notes that, quote, at the same time, this same supply management firm, readings for the manufacturing sector has weakened somewhat, perhaps reflecting the adverse effect of a strong U.S. dollar, which is also cutting the exports and the first quarter corporate earnings of big American multinationals. Meanwhile, global growth has continued to disappoint. U.S. inflation has remained well below the Federal Reserve's medium-term target, and U.S. productivity growth has stagnated, leaving the country's growth potential in question, unquote. So they are concerned, you know, about the overall, whether or not the country will slip back into a recession. The definition for recession is that if you have two consecutive quarters of negative economic growth, you know, within a capitalist society. So we'll be hearing at the end of next month whether or not, you know, their projections and whether or not the economy grew or whether it might remain flat or whether there was a contraction of it. Now, looking at the situation from the perspective of political activism, because, you know, I consider myself a political activist, we have seen an upsurge in demonstrations and other legislative initiatives carried out by the service sector workers aimed at raising the minimum wage to $15 per hour. The city council in Los Angeles just a few days ago, last week, you know, passed a, you know, a measure that is supposed to raise the wages to $15 an hour in 5 years. Okay, what would that really be worth in 5 years? What these workers are saying, who have been organizing by the service industry unions, is that the current national wage base of between $7 to $9 an hour is not nearly enough to survive in today's cities and suburbs. I mean, it's almost impossible. Even in Detroit, where it used to be relatively inexpensive to live, you can't get an apartment now in the downtown and midtown area under $1,200 a month, okay? Some places they're charging as high as $18, $2,000, $2,200. This is in the city of Detroit, you know, so you can see clearly what's going on. Plus, tens of thousands of households have had their homes foreclosed. They've been evicted. So there's a real housing crisis in the city, and it's all over the United States. They say here in New York that the homeless rate now is worse than it's ever been, even during the 1980s and 1990s. So poverty is on the increase in the United States. That's clear. And the gap between workers, especially those among the oppressed nations, Africans, Latinos, people from the Middle East, it's expanded at an even more rapid rate. In other words, we're getting poor while the ruling class is getting more wealthier. These hard facts are further aggravated and reflected in the crisis surrounding access to a decent standard of life and prospects for sustainability in the immediate future. And this is a reality, you know, in the city where I live. I just wanted to mention three aspects, and I'll close out of this crisis. In the city of Detroit, the massive job losses through the restructuring of the world system after 1975 to the present has been represented by the large-scale capital flight and outright theft of social wealth. This has been carried out by corporations, including the auto industry, how they closed, you know, dozens of plants. They've relocated, also through automation. You don't need as many workers now as you did in the past, even though there's still a lot of automobiles being produced in Detroit. But they've also set up a two-tier wage structure as well, you know, as a result of the restructuring after the bankruptcy of General Motors and Chrysler. So now you have a situation where younger workers that are coming into the auto industry are making half as much as the tenured or more senior workers. I mean, this is an effort to, of course, destroy class solidarity and, you know, and also to increase the profits of the corporations. So all of this has been done by the corporations, by the banks, the financial institutions, and their agents in government. The mayors, the city council people, and these emergency managers that they appoint, which they had appointed in Detroit, they are gone now, but they still have a state oversight committee there. So the city really can't do anything without the approval of the banks and the corporations. It is important to recount how this crisis of deindustrialization began in Detroit, which was known during World War II as a so-called arsenal of democracy because they shifted from auto production to war production in a very brief period of time. But the thing is, the actual restructuring began in Detroit as early as the 1950s, the mid to late 1950s, when the population began to decline due to both changes within the employment market as well as the deliberate, what I call suburbanization of the region through policies that were facilitated by the United States Highway Administration under Eisenhower during the 50s, where they just built expressways right through the black communities in Detroit, the two main black communities in the early 60s. Then in the late 60s, they destroyed another African-American community in Detroit. So these were systematic governmental policies that were carried out. They were planned. And also the Federal Housing Administration, you know, which encouraged white working class and middle class people through, you know, loans to move into these suburban areas, and at the same time denying loans to African-Americans who wanted to buy homes. Now, since the 1950 census, the city of Detroit has consistently lost population. A large drop occurred during the period between 2000 and 2010, just the last census. Approximately 25%, which was left the city, 237,000 people. And this was largely as a result of job losses, rising utility costs, you know, utility shutoffs. You can't live in a house without lights, without heat, or without water. It's almost impossible. Some people do, but it's very difficult. And also predatory lending that was engineered by the banks. Detroit and other African-American and Latino communities across this country were deliberately targeted by these financial institutions for these predatory loans. And they made trillions of dollars off of these deals because they were insured by AIG and other, even the Federal Housing Administration insured a lot of these loans. So when they defaulted, it was more of an incentive to foreclose on people than to keep them in their homes. So just to say what we've been doing in closing, the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice that was founded in 2002, and then the Moratorium Now Coalition that was founded in 2008, we've been demanding a long-term halt to all foreclosures, all evictions, and all utility shutoffs, including water shutoffs. We had a big problem there last summer. People probably heard about it. It was world news. Tens of thousands of households had their water shut off. And fortunately, we were able to mobilize people to oppose this. They want to do the same thing this summer. So we're gearing up again this summer to try to fight these people. The same thing's happening in Baltimore. You know, it's not just Detroit and where they had the rebellion last month. Now, the imposition of such a moratorium could be done through the declaration of a state of emergency, recognizing the failure of the capitalist market, along with the federal government, to create jobs and economic opportunities that would guarantee the people's right to employment and a minimum income. We don't have that guarantee here in this country. Nonetheless, the local, county, state, and federal governments and administrations have failed to take decisive action to protect the fundamental human rights of the majority who live in Detroit and throughout the United States. The much-championed recovery and revitalization of Detroit, and you hear this all the time in the local media as well as nationally, has not taken place amid weaknesses even cited by the capitalist theorists and the analysts themselves. Two other areas of concern for those who live in Detroit and other cities are the threats to public ownership and access to both water services and quality education. In the case of water, City of Detroit gained global attention last year when the local organizations publicized and demonstrated against the massive water shutoffs that impacted tens of thousands of households. The Moratorium Now Coalition, which I work with, organized weekly demonstrations in the financial district downtown in Detroit during last summer. The organization also brought the plight of the city residents into the federal bankruptcy hearings, which were taking place in July of 2014. So I'll just stop there, and maybe we can take up some of these issues during the discussion. Thank you.
Thank you. So now we're going to hear from Sarah Flounders. I was going to talk a little bit about Empire in Crisis internationally as well as domestically.
Good evening. I'm going to actually open with a point that Ramiro was making about describing imperialism, bourgeois ruling class. The ruling class in the U.S. today, and it's sometimes popularly referred to as Wall Street, as the 1%, it's the most powerful in history. It's also the smallest in history. Some of the figures just recently, 200 multi-billionaires own more than 2 billion of the world's population. That's a huge concentration of not just money, when we're talking about capital in terms of power. And that concentration continues and continues. It's now, some of the latest figures are 86 of the very top, the wealthiest people now own more than the population of half the world. So this concentration is continuing when we're talking about what's the bourgeoisie. And how does this absolutely impossible situation of such vast concentrations of wealth at a time when there is the greatest poverty in history, the greatest number of people live at the absolute edge of survival than at any time in human history? How is this insanity held in place? And it really is by a military machine that is unexceeded in its size, in its scope, in its power. A military machine, when we're talking about 1,000 U.S. bases in the world, the U.S. has around the world. But not only military bases around the world, it's tens of thousands of police precincts. And those who are the soldiers sent abroad come home and they're the cops using the same weapons of torture and drones. It's the largest prison population in the world. By 5 and by 10 times even other industrialized countries, the largest number of people on death row, the largest amount of torture. So it's held together by increasing repression. Now we could go on and on about the insanity of this. I wanted to take up another point that Ramiro made about it being a dialectical situation, always seeing the empire as changing. Now, if we were to look at U.S. imperialism 100 years ago when it was on the rise, when it was expanding around the world, today it is in a period of serious decline and decay, of rot, a real stench. And that decay means that the working class in the U.S. is very much targeted, as Abayomi was describing, where you have the shutoffs of such vital things as water, electricity, foreclosures, on a massive scale, of workers who were the backbone of U.S. industry and power just a generation ago. So this process of decline and decay is not an easy process for the workers here or around the world. Now, as I understood today, and Ramiro had asked us, how do we unite the struggles against the empire? This is a big question. Here we have a conference left forum, and we want to talk about what it's going to take, what kind of unity it's going to take. I think the biggest thing it will take is understanding that it's one war. There is one war underway, and it's being fought in many different places around the world. It's being fought in Detroit. It's being fought with the resistance to police assaults, with an uprising in Baltimore or in Ferguson or here in New York City. Now, I was particularly asked to focus on Ukraine and Syria and Yemen, so I do want to put some of my time and attention onto that. But also, if we're talking about it being one war, we really do need to understand that the wars come home, that the only way in which this concentrated, tiny ruling class can pay for this huge military machine is by putting more and more and more money into that military machine, into that level of repression, and ripping it from every social program that workers in past generations fought for, died for, actually won, extracted from past capital. Now, the war at home, there were some recent figures. The U.S. today ranks 57th in education. That's below any other industrialized country in the world and quite a number of other countries. It ranks highest in the number of prisons, the amount of torture, people on death row, children incarcerated, women incarcerated, figures like that. But when it comes to anything to do with social programs, and it's not just generalized poverty, we have to talk about who it's aimed at. Within the same city, a zip code apart, life expectancy differs by 20 years. By 20 years. That's the impact of racism in the U.S. And if we're going to talk about unity, it's got to be unity that is also taking into account how the ruling class holds in power through extreme forms of racism, through creating sectarian divisions, through intensifying racism and appealing to it directly, endlessly. The impact today, life expectancy for black men in the U.S. is lower than in Bangladesh. That is the amount, that's the impact of prisons. It's the impact of bad health care and non-existent health care and things like water shutoffs and layoffs and sheer stress and tension. So these figures are important because they're telling a story of what happens with the war coming home. Now, but let's at the same time address a little bit these expanding wars abroad, because if we're going to be united by anything, it is standing up to the demonization of the military and the media that justifies these endless wars. We're being told we have one enemy after another. We may know nothing about a country day one, and the next day there's an all-out effort to convince us that either Saddam Hussein or Gaddafi or Bashar Assad or Kim Jong-il or, you know, it could go on and on, is the absolute enemy of the people here and a dire threat that must be dealt with by the U.S. war machine, and that this justifies absolute hatred. So an important point of unity really could be standing up and refusing whoever they say is the enemy of the weak, the target of the weak, the justification for another war. And this is happening. It's very interesting to see that nowadays they'll do a poll, and it's sort of in the gut even of workers here, where there's a great deal of confusion, where the media never tells a straight story and is responsible for so much propaganda. And yet they'll do a poll, and 70% of the population who may know nothing about Syria are against a war in Syria for any reason at all. Now, that's very interesting because it means a lot of people here are understanding in their gut, even if they don't know the facts, they're understanding that the endless wars are running directly counter to their interests. The same is true for the Ukraine, or the arch rival and opponent and evil guy of the week may be Putin. There's hardly a day we can open the newspaper and see that there isn't a reason for U.S. intervention and arresting of people on the other side of the world and bringing them back here. And sometimes they're, quote, Muslim terrorists. And the next week, they're FIFA officials in football. I mean, and suddenly the Swiss police are making arrests in Geneva to bring people back to the U.S. This is really all about expanding U.S. power and finding a new reason a week, every week, for intervening on a new basis in one country after another. And even one area of power and concentration after another. I mean, big sports is big money today, big commercial interests. And so even an area that maybe was let go in another time, they want it all. They want to be the controllers of everything that has to do with media, with consciousness, with entertainment, with sports, with theater, with movies, and so on. So now let me just touch on one thing, because there was a real break, if we wanted to look at the last period in history, both imperialism on the rise. And during, when I was growing up, of course, the arch enemy was always anything to do with the Soviet Union, with any socialist country. All the propaganda was focused on saying, this is the evil empire, this is totalitarian, this is the total repression. And you couldn't open the newspaper any day, you couldn't turn on a news program, that at least one program wasn't to convince you of the evil. Now, 25 years ago saw a huge change, and there were many people in the left and in the peace movement that thought this would mean there would be an age of peace, that the Pentagon, the military budget, would now, there's no longer a need, there's no longer a big enemy in the world, and it would go toward social needs here. But there were other people that, because they understood what imperialism is, said, oh, we are in for an age of reconquest. It's really how to grab a hold of these countries where suddenly the barriers were down, and how to go in and grab wholesale. So NATO, which had been the U.S.-dominated military alliance in Western Europe, suddenly expanded, first into Yugoslavia and the Balkans, and then into every country of Eastern Europe. And every single country is forced to accept U.S. command and U.S. equipment. So that meant Hungary and Czech Republic and Poland and all had to buy entirely new equipment and a new U.S. command structure in order to become members of NATO. NATO expansion right to the borders of Russia, which supposedly was, they thought they were going to be a new capitalist ally, right? Yeah. They thought they were all going to be part of this new capitalist world. No, this Wall Street was determined. This was reconquest. And NATO expanded right up to the borders of Russia. And it was the effort to grab a hold of the Ukraine, and the fact that for the first time there was real resistance in the Ukraine. What happened then? Well, Victoria Nuland, she was Assistant Secretary of State. She said the U.S. invested $5 billion into reconquering, grabbing a hold of Ukraine. They set up somewhere in the area of about 25,000 NGOs in the Ukraine. Other figures, at other times, they've said they set up 40,000. That's a huge number of staff and people and media and playing all kinds of roles. But it wasn't just NGOs. It was the arming and organizing of the most fascist organizations, right-wing groups that had not existed in the Ukraine since the defeat of fascism at the end of World War II, bringing back the actual Nazi party and organizations into the Ukraine, and funding and financing it. And they set up schools and printing houses and media corporations and so on. So seizing hold and overthrowing the elected government in Ukraine, seizing a hold by fascist groupings, they thought that would solve the problem and NATO would expand into the Ukraine. And what they didn't take into account was that there would be armed, organized resistance in East Ukraine, in the industrial cities there. And that has since been termed a Russian invasion. This is really an organized resistance from below saying, no passer on. These fascists will not pass. They will not take a hold. That is what, in brief, is going on in the Ukraine. And in my ending minutes, I just want to say something also, because I was asked to address Syria. Because you also have a situation where the U.S. was determined to reconquer, recolonize the Middle East. And to do so in order to lay hold to the huge resources of oil. Now, they've been at it for 25 years in Iraq with war 25 years ago, 1990, 91. It was August 1990 when the sanctions on Iraq were imposed. That's 25 years ago this summer. And since then, all-out war on Iraq in 91 and an invasion again in 2003, an occupation, and a creation of sectarian divisions, of using Sunni against Shia and Arab against Kurd, organizing it. So every ID card, every food subsidy, every government ministry, every street is allocated on the basis of religious differences, which are consciously exacerbated with different militias, each given arms, some in the hands of reactionary Sunni, reactionary Shia. Who's going to make a deal with the U.S.? The same attempt was made in Syria to organize in a country that had been the most diverse country of the entire region. Both these countries had free health care, free education, subsidized housing, had done, made, that didn't mean that they were paradise, not at all. They were repressive societies holding on in the face of constant pressure from the U.S. and from Israel. But nevertheless, they had made real gains for the workers, for the general population. And that was, there's been an all-out invasion of Syria. Militias, mercenaries from 60 countries, and organized from actual camps and concentration in Jordan, in Turkey, huge funding from Saudi Arabia and Qatar, Turkey having 60 years of U.S. NATO bases. So all of this is an effort to bring down the government in Syria, using the same funding and bombing, direct bombing in Yemen, poorest country. They just wanted to have a democratic election. Very modest. But any sign of resistance, and I think Teresa will very much touch on, and I'm not going to address Latin America, but anywhere there is resistance and anywhere people are attempting a better life, this is a real threat to this tiny, concentrated group of reactionary power who will use their military machine, and they will do it by paying that military machine and taking it directly from us. So this is the world we face today in the decline, in the decay of imperial power.
So I guess we'll finish off with Teresa.
So I want to ask a question because I was really struck by what this compañero here said about how he is patiently waiting for the revolution. So I have a question. How many people here are patiently waiting or impatiently waiting for the revolution? Not everybody's waiting for the revolution. I'm surprised. Yeah, definitely impatiently, but still, we're all waiting for it. So that shows that we're optimistic, right? That we, despite putting on the news, despite hearing what's going on in Detroit, despite how U.S. imperialism has devastated so many worlds, so many cultures around the world, such as Iraq, despite the fact that the fourth largest city in the United States was underwater just a few days ago, despite the fact that right-wing racists in Arizona can call a demonstration against Islam and get away with it, if a black organization called a demonstration against Christians, or if Latinos called a demonstration against Christians, you can be damn sure that that group would probably be in jail right away. And yet these right-wing thugs, these racist thugs, get the chance to voice their anti-Muslim sentiment. Why? Because we live under a capitalist class. Because the bourgeoisie in the United States still has the reins of power. And we can't wait, especially those of us that come from the 60s when we thought the revolution was going to happen, you know, when we were young and vibrant and could enjoy it, right? And now we're just hoping that our young sisters and brothers are going to accelerate the revolution so we could get some good senior citizen housing, you know? But we are all here optimistic that sooner or later the revolution is going to come, and that it's going to come in the place where it has to come first. It has to come, has to happen in the United States, because every single ill, every single problem, every single social retard, every war, everything comes and stems from U.S. imperialism. Even though it's in decay, even though it's in decline, even though it's in its death throes, actually a dying animal can sometimes be more dangerous, right? And so what I want to talk about is Mexico in particular, as how it applies to our optimism, as how it's important for us to look at the Black Lives Matter movement. What does it have to do with the struggle against war? What does it have to do with the struggle against imperialism, solidarity with Mexico, solidarity with Venezuela, with Palestine, and all of that? So I want to use Mexico as an example of optimism. And I don't want to talk about Mexico just as if it's another country that we have to be in solidarity with. If any of you have ever lived in the Southwest, you would know that Mexico is not just another country that we have to be in solidarity with. That in fact, the Southwest part of the United States used to be Mexico until imperialists, you know, stole it from Mexico. And so it's the history, the relationship between the U.S. and Mexico is very, very much intertwined. And that's why for Mexicans that are born in the United States, even if we've never gone to Mexico, you know, the issue of immigration in Mexico is very much part of our DNA, because those are our roots, right? So when we're talking about what's happening in Mexico, we're not just talking about another country abroad. We're talking about very immediate consequences to the United States. And I bring this up because, as we all know, you know, all of us at the left forum, I'm sure, understand that Latin America, as has been said by many eloquent activists and theoretical leaders, Latin America and the Caribbean has historically been treated by U.S. imperialism as its backyard, that it could do whatever it wanted to, that it could steal its bananas, build the Panama Canal, carry out genocide against the Guatemalan indigenous people, and so forth and so on, and get away with it. Of course, there's always been resistance to it, but it has basically carried out a very entrenched and a kind of war against Latin America for generations now. But I want to talk about Mexico and the recent developments there to show you where the movement is going and how the movement in Mexico will impact the movement here, as it has already. When we were, you know, one of the big problems that we all face that I know all of us experience, that you could go to a meeting on Mexico, and it's primarily Mexicans. And you can go to a meeting on the Black Lives Matter movement, and it's primarily African American and some other nationalities. And you could go to an anti-war event, and sometimes it's mainly white folks, and it's mainly gray-haired white folks, you know. And it's not that we're not all sharing each other's struggle. You know, part of it is just life. I mean, how many meetings can you go to, right? How many demos can you go to? And it doesn't mean that we're not all supporting it, that is a challenge. How do we get all the communities, how do we get all sectors of the working class under the same roof, at the same time, to have the biggest impact? I don't necessarily have the answer. I do know that the class conscious elements in the movement, those that are revolutionary, those that are anti-imperialist, those that believe that we can have socialism in the United States, are the ones that you will see at all these events, right? The Reds go to everything because we sort of get how important it is to connect all the struggles. So we do offer that experience, I think, that I think is important. But on the other hand, even though the Mexico demonstrations that have been the largest ever were primarily Mexicano or primarily Latino, you did hear chants of for Ayotzinapa. In other words, you did hear chants uniting the struggle of Ferguson with Ayotzinapa, right? So everyone there was very cognizant about the importance of uniting our struggles. And many people, many of the meetings that you went to on Ayotzinapa and the struggle there, which I'll get into in just a minute, many of the Mexicanos would get up and say, Ayotzinapa is our Ferguson. And this is why we are, you know, we stand in solidarity with Ferguson. And you would see them at all the demonstrations at Eric Garner, at least the big ones, right? So I want to, you know, talk a little bit about Mexico and how here's a country like many countries around the world that U.S. imperialism has just absolutely destroyed, or has tried to destroy, because you can try to destroy a beautiful people, you can try to destroy a wonderful culture, but, you know, you can't. You know, imperialism has not been able to destroy. They have just made some serious and horrible consequences there. But if you look at what has happened in terms of Mexico by the United States recently, we all know here our schools are falling down, our bridges are falling down, our subway costs go up, but the services suck. You know, people can't go to college education more and more. It's becoming a question of the elite are only able to go to college. More and more that's happening. Yet, U.S. government finds $3 billion to send to Mexico through the Merida Initiative. $3 billion. And that's the public money. That's not the money that's being spent by the Mexican government to buy weapons. But $3 billion has gone to Mexico since 08, since 2008, to what they call the fight to the war on drugs. Supposedly, they're spending this $3 billion to fight the war on drugs. We all know that the Merida Initiative is the armed wing of Plan Colombia, is the armed wing of NAFTA. In other words, they have the trade agreements that they do with the people who come with their blue suits, but then their armed wing side is the side that the people come with military uniforms on. So the Merida Initiative is the armed wing of the NAFTA that was passed a few years ago in 94, which of course opened up Mexico more for intervention by U.S. corporations as well as Canadian corporations. So this money has gone to not to fight drugs, of course. If the U.S. government really wanted to fight drugs, they would open up the jails and they would release the 2.5 million primarily Black and Latino youth that are in jail as a result of on this side of the war on drugs, and they would provide jobs. They would raise the minimum wage not to $15 but to $25. We got to start talking about that. And they would provide rec centers. They would provide schools. That's the solution to fighting drugs. It is not. It is not to send $3 million to Mexico. I hope, how many people have read Michelle Alexander's book? Okay, if you have not read it, you really need to read it. Any activist worth their salt has to read Michelle Alexander's book, The New Jim Crow. Because this explains how the war on drugs is a war on the people. It's a war on the oppressed. It's a war on people of color. And it has nothing to do with fighting drugs. And in fact, when Ronald Reagan introduced the war on drugs, drug use was actually on the decline in the United States. And don't forget that drugs were introduced in the Black and Latino neighborhoods after our rebellion and our revolutions in the 60s and 70s. That drugs were introduced in our neighborhoods to keep us down, to keep us not fighting our class the way our enemy as that we were fighting in the 60s and 70s. So the war on drugs was introduced at a time when drug use was at an ebb, And why? Because the imperialists are really damn smart. And they know that the working class is going to rise up sooner or later. And they know that the oppressed nations of this country, Black and Latino and Asian and Arab people, all have a very good reason to be the first ones on the battle lines because of racism, because of the robbery of our lands, because of slavery. You know, that when you read Michelle Alexander's book, you just feel that slavery never ended. It just changed. It just changed. And so the imperialists know very well that people of color are going to be in the first lines of the struggles. And it's one of the reasons why jails were built and one of the reasons why drugs were put in our communities. So anyway, Mexico, I want to talk about the experiences of the Mexican people there. Because it's a great example of why we're optimistic and why we know that sooner or later, the people of this country, like the people of Mexico, are going to line up of all nationalities, of all ages, and we're going to line up and we're going to fight the ultimate fight. And that's to defeat this government and to defeat imperialism once and for all. And hopefully those of us with gray hair will get to see it, at least a part of it. Maybe not, but, you know. We will cheer you all on. But in Mexico, it's very interesting that the war on drugs, all the billions of dollars that has been spent there by the U.S. government, has resulted in bloody terror in Mexico. In the last 5 or 6 years alone, 100,000 people at least have been killed. Many more people have gone missing. And so last year, when in September 26, when 43 students went missing in Ayotzinapa, Guerrero, one of the southern states of Mexico, it became the tip. It became the tipping point of what had been going on in Mexico for so long. All of this has to do with the U.S. Every death in Mexico, whether it's at the border or inside, has to do with U.S. imperialism. And I put the blame squarely on this government for every single death. There is this incredible video that was released a few years ago of soldiers and police from NYPD and from the Pentagon training Mexican police on terror. And somebody revealed this video where the police were being taught to waterboard other police to train them on how to treat their prisoners. Now, it's horrible. You know, it's horrible that the police are being trained to do that, right, against their own people. But there's a dehumanizing and a very corrupt thing that's going on as a result of U.S. imperialism against the Mexican people, that they are living like this. The drug industry is so lucrative. Billions of dollars are made, and I forgot the actual figure, and it's somewhere in my notes, but I can't see them. But billions of dollars are made by the drug industry. And so these banks are making lots of money. You know, the drug money can come across the border. A poor migrant, a poor campesino, can't cross that border that easily. But arms can cross that border, and money from the drug industry can cross that border very easily. And so this drug industry has led to a very corrupt element in Mexico, a corrupt and violent element that is beheading the activists, that is killing the activists, that is missing the activists. And so when 43 students went missing last September, that was it. That was it for many, many, many Mexicanos. And so they were not just demonstrating. They were not just, you know, carrying out marches. They were going throughout the country talking about how to look at their struggle in a new way. And they were saying that we must be independent of the government. We must be independent of those that have profited from our pain. They want to start talking about dual power. And by that, I mean that in Guerrero, in Mexico, which is the state where this incident took place, they don't need the police to deal with their community problems. this has been an issue right here. How do you deal with problems in your community? A man is beating a woman. A father, I don't want to blame all the men, but, you know, violence against women and men are mainly from men. So a father is beating a child, you know, who do you call if you want to get help? You know, people are sort of forced to call the police right now. Although, you know, hopefully we'll get to the point in the movement where we're calling ourselves and we're not calling the people, because this is the police, because this is where we got to go, right? But in Mexico, that's what's happening. They have community control, and they are the police now. And so what's happening is that there is a situation of dual power, so that the mainstream institutions, the courts, the police, the military, the government, are being threatened literally, and the people are taking things in their own hands. And they have developed this consciousness, they've developed this class consciousness, where they are blaming all the problems on the Mexican government, but see that the root is U.S. imperialism. And so they're taking things in their own hands. And that's what we have to learn from the struggle in Mexico. That's what we have to do here in the United States. We have got to get to the point where we are, right now, because the Black Lives Matter movement has been so successful and has not pushed back and has continued to go forward. But the police are also in the offensive right now. And you can see, if you can put on the news and you see that the white cops, racist white cops in Cleveland, are charging discrimination, race discrimination, this is a racist backlash to the Black Lives Matter movement. And so that's why we need a multinational. We need Black, Latino, and white, and Asian, and Arab to come together. We need young and old, men and women, gay and straight. We need everybody to unite in order to push back the enemy at hand. And so there's no solution right now in uniting. I don't think there is. Maybe I've missed it. There's no solution in uniting right now, but we're getting to it. We're getting to it by all the many examples of solidarity that we see in so many cities across the country. We see it in the examples of the longshore workers in California going on strike on May Day and so forth and so on and so forth. So we have a lot of reason to be optimistic that one day the struggle in the United States will be just like that in Mexico.